So you'll see a section on agriculture and forestry and energy supply, and you'll get a sense of what they, actually that wasn't the last slide, you'll get a sense of what they're recommending in terms of the top priorities. And these last three slides, I'll just quickly point out, they're in here to give you a sense of what you could expect from the final report. And on the first slide, 18, you have the greenhouse gas emissions growth rates for a bunch of states. And Minnesota falls actually pretty much in the middle, perhaps in the lower middle, of this group of states with their GHG emission growth rates. That, of course, is the projection that we talked about earlier, the forecast. And this gives you a sense, this is from the Arizona report, and the blue line shows where emissions were expected to go in Arizona. The red line shows the goals that the governor set, and with the help of the climate advisory group there, and the green line shows where the measures have been scored. So in other words, taking the measures that the climate advisory group came up with, the whole package, the whole portfolio of measures, that is where emissions are expected to go. And of course, the setting of the goal was very close. You can see it was very closely tied in Arizona to what they felt that they could achieve with the sum of the measures that they identified. And you may see a table like this in the final report, which takes all of the 50 or so measures that came out of the Arizona process, and it maps it in terms of greenhouse gas savings, in the case of this chart, from highest to lowest. And this last one here gives a sense of the cost or cost savings that may accrue from implementation of the various measures. And the bars that you see falling below the line are measures that are expected to save the state money, or to save the, and by the state we mean very broadly. In some cases, like in clean cars, we're looking at the costs across the board. And because the California car program will save in fuel over time, it ends up saving the overall state economy money, and it happens to be one of the bigger savings measures in Arizona. And you can see going across the board that some of the measures are expected to cost per ton, and the highest one there was $65 per ton. And that was reducing land conversion in Arizona, which is, as you can imagine, a costly process. So there are a lot of slides extra in your presentation, and they're there for you to look at if you have an interest in the way the inventory and forecast was set up. There's other information there. I'm not going to walk you through each one. In fact, I intended to stop right here and look at questions before I move on to the cap and trade briefing.
Thank you, Mr. Litz. Based on the work that the committee has done so far, what seem to be the priorities for reducing greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota?
Let's see. Very broad ranging. The options have been narrowed down to about 60 potential options, which are available in your packet. And if you give me 1 second, I'll point you exactly where you can find them. In the last packet that has a table of contents on the top, what you can do is you can refer to each technical working group and see what their priority policy options are. So on pages 25 to 45, you have the agricultural, forestry, and waste priorities, 50 to 53, the energy supply priorities, 57 to 77, the energy efficiency, we call it residential, commercial, industrial, but it essentially is energy efficiency by and large, transportation land use on 81 to 109.
Based on your past experience, how practical are these? Are they something that we can implement here in Minnesota? I mean, is there a requirement that they be something that can be applied in Minnesota?
By the very nature of the stakeholder process, when you bring stakeholders together, you have 55 here representing a broad range of society in the state. They bring their practical eyes with them to the table, and that's really the ultimate benefit of having stakeholders decide what the appropriate measures are. These are not, for the most part, they're not policy wonks. They're people who have normal jobs, and you know, they're out there making the economy work and trying to make a better place. And as a result, I think when they look at the longer list of options, they are looking for the ones that will work for Minnesota. And so I would submit that most likely all of them are to one degree or another practical options for the state.
Okay, and I have one other question about we set some pretty far-reaching goals for Minnesota in the Next Generation Energy Act. I'm wondering if you could comment on how achievable you think those goals are for us.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question, Madam Chair. If you look at the slide that's up there, we have a table here that shows the other states that have done these climate action plans. And in the broad column in the center, you have, this is on slide 23 of the top presentation. In the table in the center, you have the state goals that were set by the state, and some of them are quite aggressive. And on the column second to the from the left, you have what the projected emissions are going to be. That gives you a sense of what each state is up against when trying to reduce emissions. And then on the far right, you see, based on the scoring of the measures in the plan, how much of the goal is covered by the plan. And so for Arizona, it was calculated that they will actually exceed their state goal by 106%, or by 6%. California set their goal based on what they thought was achievable. So it's 100%. Same with Connecticut and Maine. And you see New Mexico, which also has a fairly significant growth ahead of it. They're overreaching on their coverage. Now, let me just say, predicting the future is a tough thing to do. And so whenever you see projections that go 20 years into the future, you have to inject a certain grain of salt to go with it. But the point is that these efforts are designed to not just be shots in the dark. They're quantified and analyzed and you attempt to get to a place where you think you can go. You're not setting aspirational goals.
Okay, thank you. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple questions. I'm going back to that chart which I'm trying to read. It looks like when you list the states, the other states and their greenhouse gas forecast, it's all listed as a percent, so I assume you're talking about growth from 1990 levels. That's what that represents? Is that true, that's kind of the base you're working off of, is 1990 levels?
It's actually growth from, yes, during that time period, from 1990 to 2020.
So all of the percentages nobody has any goal to get below 1990 levels, but some percent of 1990 levels that we're aiming for stabilization in all of these?
Well, those are excellent questions, and thank you. The climate plan coverage speaks to where they'll be in 2020, not in the 2050. We don't attempt to try to predict the effectiveness of the policy beyond 2020, because, you know, and it's the nature of forecasting that the further you get out, it gets to be really a guessing game. So what you have here in the second column where you see the GHG forecast, that's there to give you a sense of the kind of growth you see in that state, and it's a measure of, man, what is that state up against when it comes to reducing emissions? And Arizona is a hugely high growth state. It's becoming the Florida of the Southwest, and so they have enormous growth in emissions. But the reason we have 1990, we measure in terms of 1990, is a number of the state goals reference 1990, including most of the Northeast states have their goals set relative to 1990, so in order to make that meaningful to you in the chart. That's the way.
And Madam Chair, where would Minnesota be? Do you have an idea what our percent is of projected growth? Do we have that number yet?
Just give us.
We do. Let me just identify it so I don't say that, state it incorrectly. I'm going to tell you what it looks like, but I'm going to, before I say that, hedge a little bit to say that the forecast is a work in progress. the members of the CCAG have looked at aspects of it, and they, certain things don't look right to them. And that's another aspect of the process, that you want to end up with a forecast that your stakeholders buy into based on their real world experience in the state. Actually, I think it's right up here. You can see on this, sorry, the screens are not, it's not great, not big for these little charts. But the initial forecast looks like between 1990 and 2020, it's roughly, you know, 58-60% growth in the initial forecast.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
I was surprised that when you have options presented back, they don't have numbers attached to them of how much reduction in greenhouse gases you could get from these different policy initiatives. Is that something the members are going to have in front of them?
To
kind of figure out the equations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through you, there are a couple of ways you could go about this kind of process. You could say, let's analyze everything, and then choose which ones we'll look at. It becomes rather unwieldy and would take quite a long time to analyze 300 options thoroughly for every state, and. So rather than do that, what we generally do is suggest that they cast a broad net on the measures, come up with the ones that look the best to them or ought to be considered, and then prioritize. And if that, after the prioritization, and after we get a sense from the group what each policy option ought to look like in Minnesota, because that we actually do the analysis. And let me just give an example. A cap and trade program, for example, which is one of the policy options, that could take so many different forms that to actually attempt to analyze what you get out of a cap and trade in Minnesota would be a futile process before you went to the stakeholders and said, tell us how you would see it play out in Minnesota. So, but it is difficult, I think, from the perspective of the advisory group members to look at a list of options. And we do hear this from the members, to look at a group of options and not really have a great sense of what the potential reduction is for each option or what the cost is. So what we do is we bring benchmarks to them based on our experience in other states. So we'll say a measure is either a high emissions reduction, has high potential, medium potential, or low potential. In terms of cost, we'll say it's high or medium or low. And we use those general benchmarks to give some guidance, but not, because it varies from state to state, we don't want to be so detailed that they end up ruling out options that would ultimately end up to be great for one state.
Representative Peterson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Litz. I'm seeing that you have, looking west, plans underway and plans completed in Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, Montana. And I believe it's correct to say that there's state policies that do not provide for the construction of conventional coal plants in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. On the 14th of May last session, the state of Montana passed a law saying any construction requires 50% sequestration. Plans completed in California and Oregon, did they take into account the recommendations of your group work in those two states as they made those laws? And since Washington, Idaho actually did no new coal in a special session during the 2006 summer, and now that Montana has the sequestration requirements, I'm wondering, with those laws enacted, what climate change plans we might be seeing from those three Northern Rockies and Pacific Northwest states as to how it relates to pending plans for two coal plants within the upper Midwest region, namely Big Stone 2 and Excelsior.
Mr. Lutz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We worked with the state of Oregon. We did not work with the state of California. So although I am fairly familiar with how California has gone about their planning, the advisory group process is meant to cast a very broad net and identify potential options. prohibiting new coal plants was not one of the options that, that the advisory group came up with. It, it could have been. I suppose it still could be. And so I, you know, in terms of the Minnesota process ongoing, that has not been identified as, at this point, I'd say it's unlikely that it would come out as a recommendation at the other end of the process, unless somebody raises it between now and the end. It was also not part of the report in Oregon or the two South Arizona or New Mexico. I can't speak to what it would do in terms of the emissions. We'd have to quantify it because you'd have to figure out where you would get your energy from in lieu of not having coal, and then what the impact of that would be, and score it out. And I hope that answers your question, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it does. And it's also good to see on the state climate goals that there's now a state of Puget Sound. The Scandinavian endorsed free trade union folks in Puget Sound are definitely working hard.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thanks for letting me ask another question. What Representative Peterson was just bringing up makes me wonder what your, you had some basic assumptions. You just said that if you didn't count on new coal, you'd have to revise your forecast. So you're basing your, you have some kind of a baseline forecast about how much new energy from different sources are expected in Minnesota?
Madam Chair.
Mr. List.
Yes, Senator, there is a, the forecast is based on a model that's used by the Energy Information Agency, EIA, in Washington, called NEMS. And NEMS projects where the electricity sector will go going forward. Now, before I even say anything else, I should say that that's one of the issues that's been raised by your group here in the state. They want to look very closely at the projections in the electricity sector. So I suspect that what we have now in the forecast is likely to change.
Senator Anderson.
And Madam Chair, I mean, obviously you're aware of our renewable energy standard we passed last session, and we're hoping that's going to make a big difference in the future. I guess I would just ask you if the members of the group have been advised about the recent approval of the Big Stone plant, because to me it seems kind of like a slap in the face to all this work that they're doing, that suddenly they've been handed this new additional job that they have to do, making their job that much harder. Right in the middle of this process of trying to figure out how to reduce emissions, suddenly they're going to, their heavy lifting is going to get a lot heavier.
Senator, we have not met since that settlement agreement came out. The advisory group has not met. They meet again September 27th. We have not worked that into the forecast process, so in figuring out how it's going to affect the forecast. Although I can assure you that we will, because when you do look at, if you do diverge from the EIA forecast that I mentioned and do something that's a little bit more organic from a Minnesota perspective, and we refer to projections that are, or forecasts that are bottom-up analyses, which refers to you look at the ground, basically, and build up your forecast based on what you know is happening here on the ground, then things like that will actually specifically get considered in the forecast. And just one last comment. The forecast, it does, of course, speak to what you're up against in terms of getting reductions. So once you have a forecast that you think is reliable and robust, you then measure your ability to meet your goals against that forecast.
Representative Virginia.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Senator Anderson's question just to make sure that I'm getting this straight. What you will do is analyze how much additional carbon will come in from this recent recommendation, which is not, you know, set in stone now, but a recommendation. And then you'll be able to tell us who else will have to pay in the economy, because you're doing this broad economic analysis, who has to pay to reduce because the South Dakota group is raising their carbon. So we will, in the end, be able to see the cost to Minnesotans of this increase in carbon. Am I getting that right, Mr. Liss?
Okay. Representative, I think you have that partly right. But let me say it before I answer the question again, and I probably should have prefaced my last answer the same way. I and the center do not decide what the forecast will ultimately look like. The climate change advisory group will decide that. And they have raised issues about the forecast, as I mentioned, and seem to be favoring a more bottom-up approach where you look at specific factors like a new plan build, or as it's referred to, a new plant that may not have been in the national forecast that we started with. So assuming that the CPEG does want to do a forecast in that way, then you will see that plant considered in the forecast. And because the whole set of measures that come from the group will be, all the policy actions will be scored against the forecast, you will be able to draw your own conclusions about what particular aspects about the forecast, the bearing that they have on your ability to meet your goals. Is that...
No.
No?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think to be useful, we know that if we're introducing a lot more carbon, somebody else is going to have to pay to reduce. And we need to be able to have that quantified so we understand who is paying for this increase. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward thing, because then we may say, well, that increase is not so good because somebody else is paying. And we have to have a pretty straightforward analysis of that, and it's just making sure that we are getting that straightforward analysis, and that's my question. Just, are we going to get a straightforward analysis?
Mr. Liss?
Madam Chair, thank you. It's captured in the analysis. That's what I'm trying to say. Plans like that would be captured in a bottom-up analysis, but there are lots of other factors that are in the forecast as well. So what, for example, any other planned build that might be in the state, or planned retirement or uprate, or even not just in the state but in the region, you'd have to take that into account. And all of those factors go into your forecast, which tells you then what you're up against. You're absolutely right. When you increase emissions in one area, it does affect your forecast, and it will affect your ability to, it will potentially affect your ability to reduce emissions. But when the final analysis is done, it's left to each individual to decide which aspects, which drivers, which factors in the forecast are what's causing the challenge. Do you follow me? Or does that help?
Representative Virginia.
Well, we will see what's driving the challenge. We will see this much carbon introduced. What I am hoping we can see from you is somebody wins, and then who loses? Who has to pay additional reductions to make up for that increase in carbon?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Liss.
David has provided me another way to state this. To the extent that plant increases the projected emissions attributable to Minnesota, then that plant will make it harder to reach your reduction goals, almost by definition. So any factor that increases emissions will make it harder, and I think generally you could say more expensive to reduce your emissions.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the indulgence letting me ask a couple of questions. I actually thought that I didn't have any yet for this portion, but the longer that we've been talking about forecasting, the more questions I've got, and I imagine that's what the what you've been getting with the larger group as well. I'm trying to figure out how the 2007 Act, with the especially with the efficiency conservation goal, how it's involved in the forecasting, because the baseline is obviously the critical piece, the measurement. And I, the more that I'm hearing, the less and less I'm convinced that there's about how it's being handled. Just so, is this 1.5% goal, like, we've been working under the assumption that the growth curve is about 2.1 to 2.5% in electrical consumption, mm-hmm. And that then we have this annual statewide goal of 1.5% reduction from that. But if we're working from a NEMS forecast, a national forecast, I think it sounds like you have some beginning answers to some of this question. So I'll wait to hear what you have to say and see if there's some follow-up there.
Madam Chair, Representative, these are exactly some of the kinds of questions that the group is wrestling with. In general, I believe that the group has landed on using around 2005 as the starting point for things, that anything that has happened before that is a part of the base case, business as usual, that would result in that line that Franz showed on one of his slides that showed the projected increase in emissions in Minnesota. So, for example, the 10% ethanol requirement would be a part of the base case. So what we're looking at is how rapidly that line increases over time. That would be what percent increase. And that there's a lot of factors that go into that. What is going to be the population increase in the state? How many more vehicle miles traveled will we have in the state? What will ultimately be the amount of electricity that people are going to be using? And then from that, we're going to try to analyze what the renewable energy standard, what benefits the renewable energy standard that was passed will make to that base case line, and what benefits the efficiency requirements will make from that base case line. And then we'll be working from there, looking at additional measures that would be needed in order to meet the goals that the legislature has set. Did that help at all?
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it does help somewhat. I think then the next question, I appreciate that no assumptions are being made about achieving goals, especially on the efficiency piece, that these are goals that we have a lot of work to do to implement. Even the 1% floor for each utility is going to be a real stretch from what we've heard, since I think we're starting to raise some questions about how much of a stretch that actually is. But so I guess I'll just pay real close attention to that and engage in some of the dialogue to just understand how those assumptions are being made. But it's encouraging to know that there's some extremely critical thought being made. And I think it's very important for the public and stakeholders to understand that no assumptions are being made here, and that no assumptions should be made anywhere in terms of performance and reaching these goals and the standards.
Madam Chair, one thing that we could talk about doing, if it's appropriate, is to come back at the time that we are a little bit closer to having a final inventory and forecast, and share and discuss some of the things that went into that. Sounds like the group might be interested in that.
Yes, and it's obvious that you have a work in progress and that we've got a long ways to go yet, and we'll be interested in hearing from you in the future. And I'm going to allow Representative Beard another question, but after that I think we need to move on. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, members, I think it's more of a comment than a question as I'm listening to this give and take and concern about what assumptions are going into your baseline. I'm looking ahead on slide 28. It talks about your reference cases assume no major changes from business as usual. And then again on page 30, you have some little disclaimers about the key points and so that you're going to be making and the things that you're not going to be that we shouldn't be paying attention to. So back to the business as usual. I believe in the global warming mitigation bill that we passed at the end of last session, we specifically carved out three exemptions that I hope you include in your assumptions. The Excelsior project, of which I'm very fond, the Big Stone project, and I think the major steel plants on the Iron Range, I think those were exemptions that were carved out because I believe the assumption was they were already underway and necessary for the economic vitality of the state. So certainly those would be in your baseline, I would think, and I don't think you should be ashamed to acknowledge that, that that's there. So just an observation as we're wrestling with what's there and what's not. And perhaps you'll talk about it again on slide 28.
Do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, just very briefly. When I referred to what you see here on these slides is how the initial forecast was done. And as I've mentioned in response to some other questions, there is a desire on the part of some of the climate advisory group members to take a more bottom-up approach where you actually look at a case-by-case, at these specific cases, and you build your forecast based on what you actually expect to happen on the ground. And when that happens, assuming it does, those three examples that you mentioned would necessarily have to be taken into account.
Okay, Mr. Thornton, Mr. List, thank you very much for the information. We'll be interested in hearing from you in future meetings.
Madam Chair, do you want to defer the presentation that we were going to make on cap and trade to a later time?
No, I think we'd like to hear that. About how long do you think that might take?
I could probably go through the slides in 15 minutes, and then assuming and then add questions to that.
I'm assuming that the members would like to hear that. Yes.
Okay, this is a presentation that we did for the Climate Advisory Group yesterday and for the Energy Supply Technical Working Group a couple of months ago, and it focuses on market mechanisms. I'm going to start with a definition of what often is meant by market mechanisms, give some examples of them, and then focus in on cap and trade, which of course is a key part of the legislation from earlier this year, and talk very briefly on how the elements of a cap and trade are affected when a state thinks about cooperating with other states around it. In general, when we talk about market mechanisms, we're looking to the market to solve a problem about allocating resources, and specifically about how to decide whether a good or a service is produced. When we apply that to the environmental context, we're generally looking to a market-based approach to supply an environmental good. And most often we're looking for emissions reductions. So we're coming up with a market-based approach that will supply us with emissions reductions. Other times we're looking for renewable energy, a market-based approach that's going to increase the amount of renewable energy in the state. So generally that's what we're talking about. And to help think about that, we generally distinguish market-based approaches from command and control approaches, where the government tends to be a little bit more prescriptive about what happens with respect to a particular issue. So it might look at a set of plants and say you must install a certain technology, might look at a set of plants and say you must burn a certain kind of fuel or limit the amount of the kind of fuel that it could use. Market-based approaches tend to get less into that kind of plant-level control and tend to focus on aggregate levels and goals. Some examples are a carbon tax, where you would set, or a per ton emissions charge levied on electric generators or whatever part of the economy you wish, and where you're setting a specific charge on the kind of pollution that comes out of the stack. Another example, as I just mentioned, the renewable portfolio standard or objective, or however you want to put it. If you allow some flexibility in meeting the overall target, for example, through certificate trading, then you may find that you reduce the cost of getting to your goal. Low carbon fuel standard is something that's been pioneered by California and is a fairly new concept. And what they're looking to do is improve the carbon profile of the fuel that enters their state. And they're going to do that in a market-based approach. I'll come back to that in a minute. And then the classic example when people talk about market-based approaches, of course, is emissions cap and trade. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But before I do, just to mention as an aside, these market-based ways of managing resources or planning strategies are also used in other contexts, like fisheries. The government, the federal government, uses it to auction off spectrum for cell phone providers and for radio providers, and it's not an unusual way to approach a problem.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry, Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, could you go back to that individual transferable quotas and fisheries? Give me an example of.
Senator Chaudhry, please use your microphone.
Just an example of how that individual transferable quotas and fisheries would work.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Sure. If the Fisheries Management Agency, and this is what they actually do on both coasts now, they'll figure out what's a sustainable harvest in a particular fishery. And then, so they'll set the overall aggregate quota for the fisheries. They then issue individual transferable quotas to the fishermen and say each quota allows them to harvest a certain amount of the marine resource, catch a certain amount of fish, basically. And overall, they're allowed to, they can trade that to another fisherman. And the idea is that the resource is harvested in the most economically efficient way because the quotas will end up in the hands of those who can most cost-effectively harvest the resource. At the same time, you're managing to keep the aggregate catch in a particular fishery no higher than what the government has decided is a sustainable level.
Madam Chair, so
Senator Chaudhry,
there might be an individual fishery that is perhaps higher than that, what that one individual fishery could sustain due to higher transfer quotas in that instance. Is that possible?
Mr. Lutz?
I suppose it is possible. There's like one area of the fishery area could be fished more heavily than previously. And that is sometimes referred to as hot spots in the air pollution context. It would be I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at, but
yeah.
To transfer it to the carbon context, what you're doing with a carbon cap and trade program is you're saying the atmosphere will tolerate a certain amount of emissions. That's where we're going to set our cap level. And beyond that, the regulatory authority doesn't worry too much about where the permits ultimately end up. They're just concerned about never exceeding that maximum threshold. So it's comparable in that sense.
Madam Chair, last question.
Senator Chaudhry.
The people who fish or live around Big Stone Lake, for example, might be concerned about particular emissions or acid rain deposits into their particular lake. Is that true?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I believe, Senator, that you're thinking in terms of localized impacts of a potential market-based program, and that concern has been lodged in many of these examples. So, for example, emissions cap and trade with respect to sulfur dioxide in New York State, where I work for the Pollution Control Agency, we were very concerned about acid rain coming from Midwest plants, and even though it was under a cap and trade, the cap and trade didn't really address the localized impacts. However, with carbon, that is almost completely not an issue. I'll tell you why. And it's where the carbon comes out of the stack, carbon will disperse in the atmosphere within a week's time, and it becomes a global concentration rather than a local concentration concern. So that is why that chemical property or that physical property of carbon dioxide, which is the primary pollutant, that leads people to suggest that market-based approaches are most appropriate in the greenhouse gas context.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think you all have a sense of what an RPS is because you've been engaged in the planning of one. The RPS is a market-based approach because it allows renewable energy providers to compete to supply the load-serving entity with renewable energy. And it's a market-based approach that achieves a goal. The achievement of the goal is the primary objective, namely the amount of renewable energy delivered in the state. So let's take the low carbon fuel standard with trading example. This is a little bit different. The government is attempting to improve the carbon profile of the fuel that enters the state. And California is doing this, as I mentioned. They set a standard and say that the carbon attributable to the fuel has to reduce. The carbon profile of the fuel has to improve over time. And this is not just a renewable fuel concept, but it's also a fossil fuel concept, because if producers of fossil fuel can produce and extract and refine their commodity more efficiently, they're improving the carbon profile of their fossil fuel. If they can also mix their fuel with renewable fuel. But the end result is to achieve a better carbon profile in your fuels. One important aspect to note is that a low-carbon fuel standard with trading will improve the carbon profile of your fuels, but it does not necessarily reduce emissions because it doesn't control the amount of fuel or the amount of carbon that is brought into the state. And these are all sort of by way of background and getting into the cap and trade, so I'm going to just, if you have questions, I'm going to try to cover these quickly.
Just one moment. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Litz says, does a low-carbon fuel standard with trading reduce the price or the cost, or does it increase it, or what is it?
Sure. Thank you. The low-carbon fuel, the trading aspect is if I'm a producer and I can refine my petroleum, or I can mix it with a low-carbon fuel more cheaply and exceed the standard, I will do that because I can sell I can earn a tradable credit by exceeding the standard, which I can in turn sell to a producer who may not be in a position to improve the carbon profile cheaply. So overall, it does accomplish the goal at a lower cost.
Chair, to the consumer.
I'd have to say that it would depend on the. You'd have to analyze that in each case as to what the cost would be to the consumer, whether there would be a net cost or a reduction.
And wouldn't somebody in a position with a large number of credits be in a very good position to sell these credits at a very high premium?
Madam Chair, the hoarding of these commodities and these market-based mechanisms is a concern that's often raised, not just in the low-carbon fuel standard context, but in the cap-and-trade context. The reason, I guess what I can say in response, is that there are existing programs out there. The sulfur dioxide program in the Northeast, we had a nitrogen oxide cap-and-trade, and there is a European cap-and-trade for greenhouse gases, and hoarding has not been observed to manipulate price.
Well, I'm sure then what's been the ultimate result as far as the price concerned to the consumer?
Madam Chair, with respect to the low carbon fuel standard, that's still being designed. It's a relatively new idea, and it's not yet in place in California. So I can't speak to what the result of it will be as yet. There are a number of studies that California has undertaken in an attempt to analyze it. And I can get it to you.
Well, Madam Chair, when you get to the cap and trade, could you tell me about it then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Litz, my questions follow on the good senator's question. You talk about the standards being developed. Who is developing the standards? What criteria are we using here?
Mr. Litz.
Who's in charge of that program?
The low carbon fuel standard in California is an initiative of the governor himself, and it's being coordinated right out of his office. And I can give you contact of the people.
Representative
Governor Schwarzenegger.
I was hoping, Madam Chair, members, for something more objective, I guess. What I'm concerned about is exactly what Senator Tomasoni was asking about. The European situation with cap and trade, I understand, actually has been a mess, with huge amounts of wealth being transferred to the power companies, of all things, who somehow amassed huge credits, and we're not really sure how that happened. I understand it's a new concept, maybe not a natural result of a marketplace, but we're going to try to make this work, so we're going to walk our way through it. It would be useful, I think, to learn from that mess and how do we apply it here. But I guess as a free market guy, what I want to know is there objective criteria that sets what a low carbon standard is, or is it something that we make up at the committee here, God help us, and assign a price to that? The standards are what I think are really crucial to this whole thing and how it works, and who starts off the program with a whole boatload of them and how they go from there.
Madam Chair, I will return to the EU ETS, the EU trading schemes issues when I go through the cap and trade.
Oh, you will? Good, okay. We'll hear about that some more then.
I wasn't going to, but I will, because of your question.
Let's continue then.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Now, I just want to compare a carbon tax to a cap and trade here. Now, a carbon tax, of course, the charge per ton versus a cap and trade, where you're establishing an aggregate limit on emissions from a certain set of sources. On the carbon tax side, your emissions reductions are somewhat uncertain. On the cap and trade side, your focus is on emissions reductions, and they're very certain. So the carbon tax, you know what your price is going to be because that's what the tax sets, and sets your price per ton. With the cap and trade, you're leaving the price up to the forces of supply and demand. There are ways to project and analyze what the price might be, but it's not as certain as a carbon tax. On the other hand, the carbon tax you don't really know what emission reductions you're going to get, because it's a function of firms will reduce their emissions, but only as long as it's cheaper than paying the tax. Otherwise, they'll just pay the tax. They both are market signals that drive emissions reductions, and they're both potential sources of revenue that can be used in a state or a region or a country to for complementary purposes or for rebates to consumers or reductions in other tax loads. I'm going to just quickly go through the basic building blocks of a cap and trade here, and as I do, I'm going to reference the European context, because I think they made some mistakes in the design of their program that go back to the basics. The first thing you do is identify the sources you want covered, and you could have the Northeast Red Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which I was involved in, of course, focused just on the electric sector. The Western states, and I'm engaged now as one of the advisors to that process, the Western states are looking to expand their cap and trade beyond the electric sector to make it economy-wide. The extent of that is not yet known. They'll have to decide which sectors to add to the program and when. Once you decide what sources you're covering, you need to make sure that you know where you're starting from. And this is where the Europeans went wrong. You have to have good, solid emissions information from the sources. And here in this country, since 1995, electric generating facilities have been measuring, monitoring, and reporting carbon dioxide emissions. And so for the electric sector anyway, we have very, very solid baseline information. In Europe, they estimated the emissions using emissions factors, and they gave countries a lot of leeway to come up with that. As a result, in this first year, it was very hard for people participating in the market to know whether there were too many allowances or too few allowances, so the price was all over the place. And that was a function of a lack of information and a lack of confidence in the starting point. And their baseline for their sources was very mushy. It was very unpredictable. So those who were buying allowances didn't know whether they were paying a fair price. Those that were selling were, of course, trying to get the highest price they could and capitalizing on that lack of information. So you establish the aggregate emissions baseline for sources, and that becomes your starting point. It can also become your initial cap, because your cap is essentially all of the emissions that you're going to allow from the covered sources. And you, in the case of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, we set the cap at current emissions. We did not initially require a reduction for the first 5 years of the program, stabilize emissions at current levels. You can do it any way. You can set your cap below current levels. You can also allow a little growth at the start of the program and then seek your reduction later. Lots of ways you can do it. The important thing is that everyone has confidence in that baseline and knows whether the emissions, whether you set your cap higher than where you're starting from, lower or at. Then the market can give you a good price for your commodity. Consumers won't end up paying more than they need to. You then determine the reduction over time. So you have your baseline, you set your cap over the sources you've determined, and then your reduction comes in the form of reduced budgets. So this year I may start at current emissions. Next year I want a reduction of 1%. So I'm going to release fewer allowances to emit into the market. And by that I mean you take your overall cap, which is a number in tons, and the government issues one permit to emit, we call them allowances generally, for each ton, and that gets distributed somehow into the market. The government generally doesn't care where those allowances go as long as every emitter of the pollutant has enough allowances to cover each ton that goes into the air. And at the end of the day, the aggregate view of the program is, of course, that the goal has been met. I keep hitting the wrong button here. So, backing up, you have a good emissions baseline, you determine which sources are covered, you set your cap based on good solid information, you determine how that cap is going to be reduced over time, the government issues one allowance for every ton that's allowed under the cap, decides whether to distribute them at no cost or charge them or pay have an auction of those allowances, and then decides how the sources are going to comply with the program. And that refers to the compliance period. Do you have every source covering its emissions every 3 years, every 1 year, every 5 years? How much flexibility do you put in the program for sources? Because at the end of each compliance period, a source is going to have to hold in his hand enough allowances to cover the total sum of its emissions. And that's the whole gist of the cap and trade program from the government side perspective. As long as every source has enough allowances to cover all of its emissions, then the system is in sync and you've met your emissions target. And of course, in order to ensure that happens, you need to have enforcement and penalties for non-compliance. And here I will just note that proponents of cap and trade programs like to point out the very high level of compliance in previous programs. There's very little non-compliance. There are lots of explanations as to why there's such high compliance. So those are the basic building blocks of a cap-and-trade program, and there's some additional corollary issues that a state looking to design a program has to grapple with. I mentioned the need to have good data to start with, and you have it for the electric sector. For other sectors, you may need to think first about requiring mandatory emissions reporting so that you can get a good solid baseline. And that, in fact, was the choice made by California. They are going to do a cap and trade that's as broad as possible, but recognizing that they need good emissions data, their first step was to require mandatory emissions reporting. Then the next question is, do you put the program across your economy all right away, or do you start with one sector, go to another sector over time, and phase it in that way? I'm going to talk about offset credits in a minute, but one big issue in the design of a cap and trade program is whether you allow offsets, and if so, how you design that offset component. If you don't know what that is, I'm going to tell you what an offset is in a minute. We'll talk a little bit more about it. Credit for early action. If the legislature decides to do a cap and trade program this year, but it's going to take a few years for the agencies to get it in place, the question is, you may not want to have the situation where firms that will be covered by your program will have a disincentive to act. In other words, they'll wait until the program starts before they do anything to improve their plans. So one way to counter that is to allow credit for early action during that period. so that the plants will modernize or install equipment with that, or at least not have a disincentive to do that, because they'll get credit. You have to think about how new sources will be treated. Remember, if you're setting a cap on total emissions from a sector, then there's a limited number of tons that go to that sector. And if you're bringing in a new plant, the issue is, well, how do you smooth the transition for those new entrants? And there are tools for that. And how to get those allowances into the market, whether through auction or distributing them at no cost to sources. Those are other issues. Do you link them with other programs that are in place? So I'm sorry if I'm talking very fast, but I want to save your time.
Okay.
What is an offset credit? And this is important in this context, because there are to date very few commercially available technologies to plant that plant owners can install on their stacks to reduce emissions. And so one way to allow flexibility to plant owners who may have fewer options to reduce the pollution as compared to previous programs for sulfur or for nitrogen oxides is to create an offset program. An offset credit allows sources to go outside of the covered sources and look for reductions and carry out projects to create those reductions. So an example would be a landfill gas project on a small landfill. If in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, that if I'm a plant, I can earn offset credits by going to a landfill that's not otherwise required to capture its landfill gas and flare it or use it for clean energy. I can go out and engage in that project and earn credits that I can apply toward my compliance obligation in the program. So that's what we mean by project-based reduction demonstrated outside of the sector, and there are lots of them. A lot of them in the agricultural sector, such as conservation tillage, is a way to sequester carbon in the soil and could be a viable offset credit for a state like Minnesota. The important thing here is to remember that when you allow sources within the cap and trade to go out and achieve reductions outside of their sector through projects like that, you're essentially allowing more emissions to come from the covered sources. But you're doing so in exchange for verifiable credits that you think are legitimate alternatives to a reduction by that plant. I hope that was clear.
Madam Chair, on that point, would you consider just paying some money to be an offset?
Mr. Lewis.
Madam Chair, thank you. See, not generally, it's not considered an offset. Paying money, I think you mean an alternative compliance payment of sorts. It's sometimes referred to that, or sometimes they call it a price cap, where you if the allowance reaches a certain amount, you pay the government a fee per ton instead of actually reducing your emissions. That has been proposed, at least on one of the federal legislative proposals. It's been a very controversial aspect of that particular bill. It's the Bingaman Spector bill.
Well, Senator, again, going back to the Big Stone agreement, I guess the offset requirement is to set some money aside, and we don't even know where it would go, so I guess that wouldn't qualify under most definitions.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. The term offset is used in different contexts, and that is a different context. That's more of an offset program rather than a cap in trade, where you allow offsets to be used interchangeably with allowances. But in the cases, there are other states like Oregon. I think Oregon may have been the first to have this, where they similar offset requirement as you have here in Minnesota, where they are allowed to pay money, and then you're able to go out and do projects using that money to reduce emissions. That's a little different from what I'm talking about here. You're in the cap and trade context. You're required to go out and demonstrate a reduction that's the equivalent of a reduction that you could get right at the plant.
Okay.
that's the goal. Just quickly from the perspective of the source, because I find that this makes it a lot easier to understand what a cap and trade is. If I'm a source covered by a cap and trade, what are my requirements there? How do I look at a program like this? I essentially have two requirements. On the one hand, I have to measure my emissions, monitor, and report my emissions to the government. So over time, I have a running tally of my emissions, and that tally is held in a government account called the emissions account. On the other hand, I know that at the end of the compliance period, I must hold enough of these government-issued allowances to cover my emissions. So I'm keeping track on one hand of my emissions tally, and on the other hand, I'm planning to make sure that I have enough allowances to cover those emissions. And at the end of the compliance period, I know that if my allowance balance in my allowance account is at least as big or greater than my emissions balance in my emissions account, then I'm in compliance. I know that allowances are freely tradable. So as I'm doing that planning to make sure that my emissions are covered by allowances, I can plan by going out and identifying other sources that may have an excess in allowances, and I can lock those allowances up in agreements, in trading agreements. Another way to look at it is, well, if I have a reduction, if I'm facing a reduction, how do I comply with that reduction? Well, of course, the plant can reduce its emissions. And what we often hear is, well, gee, there's no viable stack scrubber for carbon, so how do they do that? Let me point out a couple of ways that's been used in existing programs. In both REGI and in the EU, burning biomass or biofuel as a part of your fuel used in a plant has been considered a way of complying. So if you're using a carbon neutral fuel for 10% of your fuel, you've thereby reduced your emissions by 10% or perhaps more or less, depending on the emissions factor of the fuel. But that's one way to comply. There are ways you can build your cap and trade to give your sources options to reduce emissions that are other than putting on innovative scrubber technologies. But those innovative scrubber technologies are another way to reduce. You can also buy allowances from another source that's taken one of those paths, and you can buy offset credits. So you'll see in the discussion about the cap and trade that offsets is a big part of it. It's seen as a key part of to be able to have flexibility to comply.
Senator Kubley has.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Best. So is a carbon neutral operation, and is that considered to be a baseline, or could the baseline be set at something that's actually carbon negative?
Mr. Lutz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It could be set wherever you want to. You'd be in control of your own rules. In the REGI context, I can say that a carbon-neutral power plant would have no obligation under the program. So if they burned sustainably harvested biomass for 100% of its fuel, it would have no compliance obligation. And not only that, it would get RPS credit. That would also get, they'd be able to sell the energy credits that are associated with it. But where you set the rules is completely up to you. You could make them have to go further than that, if that's what you wanted. And then just a couple of notes on regional cap and trade programs. I just noted up there when you saw the states in the upper Midwest that had done climate change plans. There are four states, including Minnesota, in the upper Midwest who are moving on this issue. And so thinking about regional approaches in the upper Midwest or approaches that tie the state to other regions, whether it's in the Northeast or the Western states process, may make some sense as an option to consider. The benefits, of course, of a regional program is that you add more sources. And the more sources you have covered by a cap, the more likely you're going to find the low-hanging fruit. You're going to find innovation. If I'm a developer of new technology, if the market is bigger, and say if I know a cap and trade covers five states, that's my potential market for my new innovative scrubbing technology. I'm going to be much more likely to make the investment in the new technology if I have a bigger market. And then more players in an emissions trading market make it a better market. In the European market, we talked a little bit about the bad information they had about the emissions baseline, and that really affected how the market performed. Prices were high, they were really low, then the price fell out of the market. If you have a lot of players in your market, you're more likely to have confidence in the price that's set. You'll have more information about the transactions that occur, just like any other commodities market, whether it's pork bellies or anything. The more information you have, the better you are at guessing what the fair price of the commodity is. And correspondingly, the better chance of realizing your goal at the lowest possible price. And more states lessen the potential for leakage. So if you, that refers to the case where one state has a cap and all the states around it do not. And so what happens is the constrained area simply invites more imports, and the emissions that go with those imports are not capped. So the bigger the program, the better in that sense. And then this is just the last point, Madam Chair. In terms of the mechanics and the building blocks of a cap and trade program, they're really no different in the regional context, except that what you have is a bunch of state programs that agree to work with each other. So if Minnesota had a program with Wisconsin and Michigan, you would be saying, okay, Wisconsin, Michigan, we will recognize your allowances in our program if you will recognize our allowances in yours. And the result is that you could have, and this map, forgive me, has the western states as the example, but you have a situation where from the source's perspective, from the covered entity's perspective, they don't care whether the allowances or the reductions occur in another state. They're looking to find the cheapest reduction, and the trading occurs seamlessly across the borders, and the cap is ultimately maintained. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. I think I heard you say during the basic building blocks presentation that consumers won't have to pay more than they need to. And then I didn't hear you elaborate on cost to the consumer or what happens in Europe as to cost to the consumer. And this is kind of like the flip side of the highways and bridges arguments about energy being sold there. I mean, the difference is that you have a meter at your house that somebody reads, and then you get a bill, and you got to pay it regardless of what the cost is, or they shut the power off. Whereas when you go to the gas pump, if you raise the gas price of gas and fix the highways, you can actually see the pump the gas, and you can stop and pay whatever you need to pay at that point in time. But we are sort of giving what kind of assurance do we have to the consumer that suddenly the cost of energy isn't going to go out of sight and we're going to have more than 50,000 customers shut off like we were, like happened here in Minnesota just recently?
Mr.
Madam Chair, thank you. First, just based on existing experience, there was extensive analysis in the regional greenhouse gas initiative context that estimated that the price per ton of carbon would be around $5, between $5 and $10. Between the start, which is early January 2009 through 2015. Now, what does that mean in terms of translating into consumer prices? The residential household in New York was going to see an increase in their electricity bill annually of under $30. So it wasn't a huge hit. However, let me say, but that doesn't mean that the same exact program applied in Minnesota or across a bunch of states in the upper Midwest would yield the same cost impact projections. In fact, they would most certainly be different. They could be less, they could be more. And the point there would be that once you have your program designed, you need to analyze what the expected impacts would be, and then you decide whether those are acceptable to you or not. And I would say, generally, the cost that a program imposes on the economy is directly associated with the reductions that you seek to achieve and any complementary measures that you're able to undertake. So if you're able to stimulate energy efficiency in the electric context, at the same time that you reduce emissions, generally you'll find that the price will be the price in fact is moderated heavily. But if your focus is purely on emissions and you're not looking for ways to maximize efficiency at the same time, then your impacts will generally, I think, be higher.
And then what happened in Europe?
In Europe, the price went up to like 35 euros at one point, and then the price completely fell out. As soon as it became, the information came out to the people in the marketplace that there were actually more allowances than there were emissions. There was no reason to pay anything for the allowances. You know, they're basically worthless. And so in the first three-year period, which is a trial period, they've called it, the price now for an allowance is essentially zero. But in the second period, where they have good emissions information, because they've actually had sources monitor the emissions, the price is around 16 euros the last time I checked. So it's, I guess it's about $20.
Representative Spearson, and again, we do need to move along. I know that this is a very interesting topic. We will revisit it a number of times, but we do have a full agenda, too.
We will be revisiting it again?
We will revisit it.
I'll be brief then, because I'm thinking when we're talking about the price that you threw out, and again, it was just conjecture, that there actually are two other variables that are in there, which gets back to the question we asked a few moments ago. If we fiddle with the standard, that's going to affect the price. And if we monkey with the allotment of pollutants that we allow in a year, that's going to affect the price. If we keep changing the benchmarks, that's why I was asking who's setting this and how does that work? Because I can just imagine a group of people like us sitting around thinking, wow, they're hitting their targets every year. This must be too easy. So let's turn some screws down a little bit, and there goes the price, and then the consumer gets to pick up the tab again. So.
Mr. Lutz.
Madam Chair, thank you. I mean, that's an excellent point. Just like with any other instrument that's going to affect markets, and this is a place where the Europeans really screwed up. I mean, they set up a program that lasted for 3 years, and so when we did it here in the U.S. for acid rain, for example, it was an indefinite program. I knew if I was a plant owner and I made an investment on my plant that would reduce my emissions, I knew I could recoup the benefits of that indefinitely into the future. Whereas for them, it was not clear that reduction was going to be worth anything 3 years from now.
Then I assume in the acid rain example, we must have had a standard we set and then let alone.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so long-term predictability is a key. If you read the literature on these programs, that is considered a key ingredient.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your time and the information.
Thank you very much for your time.
And we'll be looking forward to future updates, too. Let's call now on the Department of Commerce regarding studies that are underway. Deputy Commissioner Garvey. Before we get started, members, you have a reimbursement form in front of you for the LCC and your attendance here today. You would sign that and either leave it or turn it in to Denny. We'll see that you get credited. Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, my name is Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I was asked to provide an update on energy issues that are sort of underway in the Department of Commerce. I have prepared a packet for you. This packet with a little table of contents, the overall topics of the reliability administrator, the studies and reports And it's my understanding that there may be some questions upon about the Big Stone settlement, so I provided some materials on that too. Now apparently they're sort of whistle through this. I know that you have still most of your agenda still to go through, so I don't want to take up any more time than I need to. The reliability administrator, which was very, very ably filled by Ken Wolf, who has retired, but that position has now moved back to the Department of Commerce. A number of projects and responsibilities were added to that already important position. In order to proverbially hit the ground running, we concluded, and Commissioner Wilson, in my recommendation, appointed me as an acting interim reliability administrator. There's a letter from Commissioner Wilson in your packet that describes the rationale behind that, as well as the job posting, because we do want very badly to fill that position as quickly as we possibly can with someone competent. So if you know of anyone who is capable and interested, please pass along this job posting to them and have them contact me. The reliability administrator responsibilities are, besides sort of providing a resource to Commissioner Wilson, myself, and the Public Utilities Commission, also some specific tasks. A baseload resource assessment study as part of the Next Generation Energy Act that was signed into law earlier this year that you authored. It does not have a deadline, but we are shooting for a November 08 timetable. It'll be one of the first of its kind for the state. Generally, we do resource planning on a system by system, as in a utility by utility basis. This will be one that we roll up and aggregate the resource needs of the respective utilities. It'll be a very big project with a lot of efforts involved. Resource plans come in starting November 1. We'll see Great River Energy and Minnesota Powers. XL Energies will be filed on December 15th. So the three largest utilities are coming in. The law specifically suggests that we look to those resource plans as a foundation for the baseload study, but we will need to build off them and the other utilities whose resource plans are not coming in quite as soon and gather that information back. But we do hope to have and plan to have and intend to have a baseload study for the state of Minnesota by November of 2008. Another study that the reliability administrator has the plan of the transmission and authority and interconnection evaluation. This is the question of how do we interconnect with the grid. How are other states and regions doing this? Learn from them, build on them, take from them, add to our already good programs, and improve on it. That study is due February 15th of next year. And those are the reliability administrator duties. Madam Chair, members of the task force, let's move right on to the Department of Commerce studies. If there are any specific questions on that?
I have specific questions on what has been done in terms of identifying. There were two I remember. One was the baseload needs for the state. And is that something being left for the reliability coordinator? Is that what the position administrator? Or is that something that your department is doing? And the other then is the directive to develop a regional plan for cap and trade or for transmission and cap and trade and renewable energy.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, the baseload study is specifically assigned to the reliability administrator by the statute. It is one of the reasons why we felt that it was important to at least assign me as an acting in an acting capacity so we can start getting those things underway, so that when we do find and can actually hire a formal reliability administrator, we don't lose the time between now and then, and we're already underway. Greenhouse gas, addressing greenhouse gas emissions issues is a assignment to Commissioner Wilson at the Department of Commerce, and that is actually one of the topics I'll touch on under that category of the Department's studies and reports.
You can go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the Department of Commerce studies and reports, the first one that's on the list is the Transmission for Renewable Energy Standards. This is not a Department of Commerce study. It's a study assigned actually to the state's utilities, but the Department of Commerce has been asked, and we are most willingly assisting in that effort. It is due November 1st. It has a very tight timetable. The goal of the study is to basically ascertain whether our transmission grid has the capabilities to meet the renewable energy standards. It does not, as my personal observation, technical expertise sort of says, but it also is to identify where it doesn't and what we can just start doing to upgrade the transmission grid to meet the renewable energy standards. Many of you are well aware of CapEx, and those 600 lines that are already proposed. There's a phase two coming down the line. This study will start being thinking about beyond CapEx. Clearly, the transmission grid needs to be improved, expanded, upgraded, not only for grid reliability, but also to provide conduit for the renewable energy that we expect and want on our system in the coming decades.
And may I interrupt just a minute to notify the members here that we've just been notified that there may be some challenges in interconnections and transmissions and getting the new new legislation up and running for the state. And so we will be having an update on this in a report at the next meeting that we have of the LEUTF.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, the second bullet item is a proceeding to establish cost of future carbon dioxide regulation. And this also is part of the statute. It's an obligation upon the Public Utilities Commission to come up with a range of costs that it expects utilities to have to deal with for carbon. It asks for the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce's assistance in that. It has a deadline for the Public Utilities Commission of January 1, 2008. In order to facilitate that, the Department of Commerce, in a letter that I sent to the Executive Director of the Public Utilities Commission, Burl Carr, and you have a copy of this letter in your packet, suggested that the Commission adopt a nine dollar planning number as an interim basis and do that quickly, and then open up a docket for more comprehensive study and evaluation to develop a more formal range to replace that interim number. That allows the commission to comply with the law. It allows puts the utilities on notice of what the numbers that they should be thinking about in the context of the resource plans and other resource acquisition filings, while at the same time allowing for a more formal and thoughtful vetting of what actually should be the range of numbers that the Public Utilities Commission would expect our utilities to incorporate in their resource plans and resource acquisition issues. Madam Chairman, the third bullet is the Climate Change Action Plan. You just heard a very, very thoughtful and, I thought, useful presentation from Franz Litz of the Center for Climate Strategies, who is the consultant to develop that plan. It's a plan that the Commission Commissioner Commerce's to develop and present to the legislature and the governor by February 1st, 2008. I don't think I need to go anything more than that, but I'll certainly be able to and take any questions that you may have on that. Madam Chairman, members of the task force, the next bullet, the fourth bullet is the Regional Climate Activities Report. This is a report that you directed the Commissioner of Commerce to file with the overseeing chair by February 1st, 2008. It is the regional connection is something that's very, very important, specifically in the Carbon area. It's an area where we have already spent a great deal of time and activity, and I gave there are two things in your packet that I just want to bring to the task force's attention. First is that the governor in July of this year became the chairman of the National Governors Association. The chair of the National Governors Association under tradition, is allowed to pick an initiative that he or she may lead with the support of the National Governors Association and the other governors. Governor Plenty has chosen energy and securing a clean energy future as his initiative. And Madam Chairman, members of the task force, if you turn to the inside, one of those issues, of course, is taking reasonable steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And in that context, we are paying attention to and trying to reach out and work with our neighbors, not only sort of specific bordering state neighbors, but neighbors across the continent. In another forum, the Midwest Governors Association, which Governor Plenty is the past chair of, the immediate past chair of, and therefore serves on the executive committee. Energy is one of their issues that they are taking on with regional carbon trading or carbon constraining sort of coming together. It's still sort of an amorphous. We are trying to sort through with our neighboring states, specifically those in the upper Midwest. But we certainly welcome those that are not so upper, perhaps down in the Ohio Valley area, to join us in those kinds of endeavors. This will be more thoughtfully and comprehensively fleshed out in the report that we'll be making to you in February of next year. The next set of studies and reports, off-site renewable distributed generation, state government energy savings plans, geothermal heat pump systems. Those are studies that we are starting to scope out for ourselves, assigning staff to start working them up. But we will meet the deadlines of, you know, February 1 or March 15th. The statewide study of dispersed generation potential is a very, very important one. It's one that is already being worked on, both by commission staff, by department staff, rather, by the utility, and others that are thinking about that kind of question. Phase one is due on June 15th, 08, with a more comprehensive one due the following year. We are also have a series of studies that are due on reports on the propane, a hydrogen roadmap, and a report on rural wind monitoring. These are also reports that are sort of on the to-do checklist. We are working through them, figuring out what exactly they will take, with the scope of work, with the assignment of staff, the bringing of partners and collaborators on those.
Seems like your plate is full.
Madam Chair, our plate is very full, but we're bearing up.
Okay. Any questions about those studies at this time? Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Garvey, the statewide study of dispersed generation potential. Remind me again what that's about and where that came from.
Commissioner Garvey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Representative Beard. I am not necessarily the best person. Assistant Commissioner Mike Bull is our lead person on that, who is actually on the road with a series of public hearings on these kinds of issues. My understanding is, subject to sort of a correction by way more knowledgeable people, that is a bit, it's to figure out how on our grid that we have now that we can start taking advantage of those kinds of capabilities. And then we move up the chain. So what is the potential within the context up to the first generation on the current grid network?
Good, thank you.
Okay. And we will revisit these studies in the future, too, with perhaps more knowledgeable people. Huh?
I'm not sure that wouldn't be hard. Well, Madam Chairman, I think that sort of concludes my presentation on the Reliability Administrator and Department of Commerce reports and studies. It was my understanding that there were some members that had questions about the Big Stone 2 settlement. I would be happy to sit for questions at the members they have.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Garvey, you've clearly described that you're pretty busy, but I just have to say, I think you might have forgot one thing in the settlement agreement, that your January 30 letter refers to seabed development of 120 megawatts to be located in the counties that will host the proposed transmission facilities. In the settlement agreement, Section 7 on renewables, 7.2, page 15 through page 16, the stated amount of 180 megawatts is made. And I'm quite well aware that you don't need to go above and beyond the RES percentages to satisfy a certain amount of seabed, because I guess there's no extra required. But the line about affected counties host that will host the transmission has been dropped. I'm wondering why that got changed.
Mr. Garvey.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Representative Peterson, the proposal that the department sent on January 30th, 2007, listed a number of things that we felt were important. We then engaged and continued the litigation, at the same time engaged in conversation that ultimately led to the settlement. There were certain matters that we felt that were worth more important to get than others, sometimes not consciously, only unconsciously, perhaps, sometimes consciously. We felt that that getting the commitment that 24% of the Big Stone Partners RES commitments by 2012 to be seabed, to have a number significantly higher than the 120 that I proposed, was valuable and important to get. We felt that while we hope and we will sort of encourage the partners themselves to look at the counties where the facilities themselves are hosted, at the same time we wanted to encourage the seabed and maximize the breadth of those capabilities and why it was so limited. So we felt it was a reasonable trade-off. And that's how that came about.
Representative Peters.
One follow-up. Last week it was announced that there's plans for a 300-megawatt seabed project in Olmsted and Maurer counties being proposed. And it goes on to say from the American Wind Energy Association that there's a requirement of 1,200 megawatts of seabed by 2025 in the state. Assuming 5,000 megawatts in the RES, that's 25% of the RES for seabed, quarter for seabed, maybe a quarter for IPP, maybe a quarter for the utility, and maybe a quarter for some sort of a hybrid community partnership language that we might have saw last session during conference committee. So somebody on the AWEA board, of which Xcel is the first utility to be on the American Wind Energy Association board of directors, has made the policy call that there exactly is a 1,200 megawatt requirement under the RES for seabed.
although the statute does not say that. So I'm wondering if there's a 300 megawatt project in the works under the evolving definition of seabed, and there's proposed lines in western Minnesota where in January there was located in the counties that will host the proposed transmission facilities, and now it's sort of we're going to encourage them. I'm just wondering, like, you know, it seems like the global business folks, like we've desired for a long time, at least me, have wanted the attention for renewable energy in the western part of the state and in other places, and it seems like that the business folks are making statements about where it's going to be and how much is required in the state of Minnesota, but yet I don't find a lot of formal activity around. How do you say it? Put it this way. I know there's county commissioners in my district who made comments during the Big Stone 2 public hearings that said, we just don't want the transmission lines. We actually want some seabed if you're going to have transmission lines. Have you taken into consideration that those county commissioners serve long terms and have planning and zoning of their own in those counties and can, in the past, cause a lot of headaches for transmission siting across the state? And maybe the part about forgetting that it should be in the counties that are affected by transmission would be something that the partners could consider putting back into this pending agreement going before the PUC.
Deputy Commissioner?
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, we think we have a very good comprehensive settlement here. It is not the final word by any stretch of the imagination. The final word will be held by the Public Utilities Commission. There'll be a number of parties and stakeholders who are already involved in it. I'm sure will weigh and comment on it. In addition, there'll be the implementation of this, and I think Representative Peterson has brought up a very good and useful point, and I'm sure members of the audience have made note of it that are related to the Big Stone Partners, and I certainly have.
Okay. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Harvey, first I just want to express again the pleasure I had working with you on this fifth efficiency legislation last session. And I think we did some really good work. I think you can imagine my surprise in reading the agreement that I think reflects different than what the clear intent of the statute is, and certainly what the partners said to us in committee. And ironically, I think that it looks like all of our agreements on the at the table actually are missing page 4 of the settlement agreement, which has item M. But which is kind of the cornerstone of the pieces. But I just want to make sure that I have this right, since I'm going from memory of that item in the background summary. But it's just essentially that all partners in Minnesota, all Minnesota partners in Big Stone 2 will achieve the 1.5% fifth goal, 1.5% annual retail energy savings. As you know, the Senator Dibble and I worked very hard and recognizing from what we had heard that some of the partners are at 0.3% currently in their filing of savings. And we recognized that the stretch of 1.5% was exactly that, a stretch. And so we moved down to requiring 1%. I think that you look at the record, you look at our testimony, you look at what was said on the floor, you look at the conversations that we had, it was 1%. Are we seeing that all partners are agreeing that they will not appeal down from 1.5% in their fifth filing?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, Representative Kalin. When the department was analyzing this proposal last year, when we were still in the SIP spending requirements paradigm, we recognized that most of the Big Stone partners had not done an adequate job in energy efficiency. We wanted them to do more. We said that because they had not done it, that they had not met our criteria for granting a certificate of need. And the letter that Representative Peterson has already referenced, dated January 30th, expects the each applicant to establish the goal of achieving annual energy savings equaling 1.5% of forecasted energy sales, et cetera, et cetera. So we said that as our condition, expected condition in January. The events overtook us with the legislature and the adoption of the Demand Efficiency Act, which Representative Kalen, you were the champion with working with you, Madam Chair, and Chairman Hilty on. So the expectation is that they meet the 1.5. And that is our expectation, we so say it in the agreement itself. We see no reason why any utility can't meet 1.5. We understand it's aggressive, but we believe it's achievable. We believe that having the Big Stone partners reiterate that and have their senior executive officer signing an agreement that they will meet that is of value.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kalen.
Thank you. And Commissioner Garvey, I think the obvious question that gets raised then is the question of a goal or a standard. Page 13, item 4.9 of the settlement agreement talks about offsets beyond that required by law around the energy efficiency performance, and that obviously the SIP filings become, in this case, essentially a standard of sorts, but only a standard insofar as offsets can be gained. I'm just trying to understand the logic here about when forecast, or when what was communicated as a serious stretch of 1%. I think if my memory is correct, Representative Westrum was very helpful in identifying in committee that 1% was an agreeable stretch, but that it was reasonable and doable, but a lot of them sort of, a lot of the representatives took a very deep breath in committing to that. But there's no consequence. I mean, we built in it's based around a good faith effort to get the goal, and the consequence being when we go before the PUC for a new energy facility. I'm in a position of trust to verify, and I'm having a hard time verifying that the assumptions and the calculations are on here, and that you can commit to a goal but not have no consequence for meeting that goal, for not meeting that goal, excuse me. I'm just wondering if you can comment a little bit on A, the offset piece, but then B, the goal versus standard, and kind of helping. I just want to make sure that we were both operating on the same assumption.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Representative Kalen. There were a number of utilities that exceeded the 1.5% savings requirement that was adopted in the demand efficiency. There were very few of them. I don't have the exact number, and you may know more than I am, but I believe I'd be sort of truly shocked if I learned that more than one member of the Big Stone partners actually were coming close to 1%. Most of them were at the 0.6 to 0.7% range from my recollection. So moving to 1.5 was effectively a doubling of their retail sales. One, that's our base. We still believe very strongly that it is an aggressive goal, the 1.5 to get to the 1.5%. We think it is paramount that utilities achieve it. We think they can achieve it. We think it's in their best interest, and we think it's in their best interest of their ratepayers. We think that their commitment and compliance with the law was a critical component to our removal of our objection in the signing of this agreement. So to the extent that they don't meet that, they would be violating our understanding of how this agreement came about. As for the offset issue, there are three components in the offset issue. There are nine components of the offset issue. There are three components that are what I characterize above and beyond. They could get carbon credits if they go above and beyond. If they go above and beyond transmission development for renewables, they go above and beyond renewables, if they go above and beyond for energy efficiency, they can get carbon credits for those emissions that would be offset. Those would not be determined by myself or them, but would be ultimately reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission to prove what's above and beyond and what's the crediting amount. We do want to open up the doors. We do want to encourage utilities to go above and beyond on these kinds of issues. So the goal versus the goal versus objective versus standard is we believe that the 1.5, the 1 plus a half, should be achieved by our utilities. We want them to achieve it. We're going to help them to achieve it. We're going to expect them to achieve it. In the context of this agreement, it's part of their agreement. It's part of what they've agreed to do in return for our agreement that they have complied with the law and deserve a certificate of need.
Representative Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one last question. First, just a quick statement that the Exhibit D, I just had a lot of questions about the calculations, and so we'll do that. I think it's a technical piece that we'll just have to walk through, and so not asking you to do that right now. But I think not only do we not want to expose any questions that you've admitted to about competency, I don't want to expose any questions but my own competence. So we'll pretend like we're both experts and keep moving. But the 390 gigawatt hours of savings that you're at in item M of the summary that's on our missing page 4, you're asking to introduce that into the record before the PUC. And then I just heard you say that 1% is what we continue to, that you and I both share this 1% understanding, that that ends up being 260 gigawatt hours. It's a significant difference in terms of looking at how you satisfy this need. And then we're under 4.9 again, that they're going to be allowed offsets beyond that required by law, and the law will be determined by the SIP filing as approved by the department. It's a there's a lot of contradiction in there. There are a lot. This raises far more questions than it answers. And I think that there. I think you have a lot of work to do to clarify these numbers to match up not only with the intent and the specific language of our demand efficiency article, but also just of the. What you're asking the PUC to rule on. My fear is that we have a 1.5% goal here, and then obviously then the SIP filing will be a minimum of 1% for all the partners where incentives kick in. I think we've allowed even to change incentives from 90% down to something even more reasonable, and I supported that. So they could be at 0.8%, get offsets, start getting financial incentives, get offsets at 1%, and be reaping a heck of a lot of financial advantage here, and still leave the commission under the impression that they're getting 390 gigawatt hours by 2020. Let's just assume that those calculations are right. I guess it's a warning as much as anything that we need to get these numbers right first and foremost before anything else, before any discussion about kind of how to clarify all these other bigger issues.
Deputy Commissioner, do you wish to comment?
Madam Chair, members of the task force, it's a very helpful thought and perspective that you've offered. The way we, the department, looked at this issue, and I know this is the way the Big Stone partners were looking at it, is that this is an affirmation of their expectation to meet the 1.5. And what we tried to do is codify that expectation more clearly than their legal obligation. So to the extent that you're looking at it as a possible short changing of it, we weren't seeing that at all. We were seeing it as a more explicit affirmation of them meeting the 1.5, in addition to the other issues of rate design, block rates, and those kinds of things, and aggregation that we also have in the section. So thank you for the warning and the thought.
Yeah. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really just have a comment, not a question per se. I guess just to start, I don't believe that, you know, I think as we left last session, we really didn't have a consensus across the legislature about what to do about the Big Stone Plan. I think that we left that open. And we left that open to the regulatory process. And I personally had a lot of faith in our laws, because we have pretty strong laws in Minnesota about the requirements for a certificate of need, which is what this case is all about. And, you know, I was looking back at the department's brief, which I read a lot last legislative session, from January 30th, where the department had analyzed the case made for the Big Stone certificate of need, and had said that they found, their experts in the department had found that the applicants had not met the requirements of Minnesota law. Our Minnesota law is very clear. It says if you have to show you cannot meet the need for this power, you know, by renewables or efficiency. And they didn't make that showing. And so it's extremely disappointing to me to have the Commerce Department come together and reach a settlement agreement now that just flies in the face of what your experts and your brief signed by you, I'm sure, Commissioner Garvey, said just 8 months ago. And as far as I know, nothing has changed in these legal requirements. I mean, we certainly didn't change the law, and I don't think that the deficiencies here have been fixed. I think you decided to go along with the proposal without following Minnesota law. That's the way I see it. I don't think Minnesota law has been met in the settlement agreement. And so I'm really disappointed, and I really think, you know, I admire very much what the governor is doing around the country, but I see this as completely inconsistent with what he's saying. And I understand the good intentions of talking about offsets from the carbon dioxide. We talked a lot about that last session and what they would mean. The governor had that, and Senator Brenton Solon had that in your bill. I had it in my bill about requiring offsets for new coal plants and requiring that if Big Stone went forward, they'd have to offset their carbon emissions. But I don't think that's what's in the settlement, because it allows them, the companies that are the Minnesota partners, to just put some money into an account in their own company. It doesn't say what they have to do with the money. They don't have to give it to anybody. They don't have to use it for any particular purpose. And they only have to do it for 4 years or until we pass a law. That's what it says right here in the settlement agreement. That's not an offset requirement. So, you know, I'm just really disappointed. And I don't know, as I said earlier, it just seems so counterproductive to be doing this at the same time that we have the highest level group we've ever had in state history putting all this effort and time into figuring out how to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And here we are saying, well, we're not going to follow our own law, and we're going to increase emissions by 4.7 tons a year. Most of that coming to Minnesota customers. And I just can't fathom why our state agencies and governor would agree to that.
Do you wish to comment?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I do. Thank you. Members of the task force, Senator Anderson, let me just go through. You have in your packet the an excerpt, if you will, sort of of, and I hope it's completely copied, of the January 30th, 2007 filing, signed by, prepared by my staff expert, signed by our lead lawyer on it. It includes the policy letter from myself outlining our term, but it also sort of includes at the very end, you see pages 3 through 87 omitted, potential conditions if the commission approves the application. We made crystal clear from the beginning that there were issues and there were ways to address the department's concerns. So let me explain to you why we did that. We did that because there is not a doubt in our analytical expertise that there is a need for additional energy for the applicant applying utilities. We believe that amount of energy was about 1,000 megawatts. We believe that they did not do enough for renewables, that they did not do enough on energy efficiency, and we so argued. At the same time, we could not ignore the need for energy for these utilities. It's worth noting that we made that argument, and we made that very strong argument to the administrative law judges, who identified the same underlying issues that we had, and therefore rejected our argument and made a recommendation in favor of granting a certificate of need on the same underlying rationale that we were thinking about pursuing this settlement. That, yes, they can and should do more on renewables. Yes, they can and should do more on energy efficiency. Doing more on renewables, doing more on energy efficiency would reduce the amount of energy that these utilities would need, but it would not eliminate that addition, and therefore the ALJ concluded that it was worth, that they had met the legal burden and recommended that the Public Utilities Commission approve the certificate of need. In the meantime, we were negotiating with these entities to get things that were very important to us, that we didn't have direct legal jurisdictional authority over. This is an application for transmission, not for the facility itself, because the facility is not located in Minnesota. We used our authority to permit the transmission to reach beyond our state border to a facility outside of our state. We did that because we think that providers of electricity to Minnesotans should be held to the standards that we expect. We negotiated and asked them to offset their carbon emissions. We negotiated and asked them to address and protect Big Stone Lake. We asked them to protect and do something about mercury. We applied under this agreement Minnesota's mercury laws that we passed in 2005, nation leading on mercury reduction. And then we added in our renewables and our energy efficiency laws. So you still needed energy from this facility. And that's why we signaled that we were willing to have a discussion. That's why we had those discussions. The ALJ rejected our legal arguments. I'm glad we were negotiating and we were able to actually come to a resolution, because if we hadn't, we'd be in much worse shape now than we would have been, because the ALJ had rejected our arguments and they carry a lot of weight. So at the end, what we have is an agreement that sets a very high and significant environmental protection bar on a set of facilities, a generation facility and transmission facility, that we think we need, that can serve Minnesota well and the region well. And I understand that people are seeing this a little bit differently, and that's what makes our process powerful, because through those kinds of differences and tensions, we get the better deal. So, Senator Anderson, I hope that that at least explains why we did what we did.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I guess, you know, part of, you know, what bothers me with the modeling that was done by the utilities and what your own department's experts had to say about that modeling, it seems to me that they were saying that it was really too flawed a process to reliably indicate the need for the 600 to 620, 630 megawatts, whatever it was, much less to the 1,000, you know, so I'm not sure where that 1,000 came from, but, you know, that's kind of a moot point, but, you know, I guess, you know, if those flaws were found by your own people, you know, why are those flaws not, or the deficiencies that were found in that modeling process, why aren't they addressed in this agreement? You know, it doesn't seem to me they are.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Kubley. We first asked the utilities, and the utilities have to file an explanation on why they need new power, and we call that a forecast. Here's what they think over the next blank number of years. And from that, we analyze them whether they're basically making appropriate forecasts. And that's where you basically sort of say, yes, they need additional power. We need additional energy in this state. We need it on most of our energy, most of our utility system. The question then becomes, what type of energy do you need? Can it be handled through renewables? Can it be handled through efficiency? Is it a peaking kind of issue? Is it a intermediate kind of resource? And that's where, in many respects, much of the fight was. It wasn't necessarily on the forecast per se. It was on the discussion of can this energy be replaced or met, if energy need met, by renewables and energy efficiency. We concluded that it could be significantly reduced but not replaced. The second part, that specifically to answer your question, is in the intervening time from January 30th to the adoption of the Renewable Energy Standard and today, at that time, we were having under a renewable energy objective and we were under a spending up requirement. We've made dramatic and very important and significant changes in that expectation that now we have a renewable energy standard and we have a demand efficiency goals that they are expected to meet. So that in many respects we sort of said, all right, instead of basically saying they have to meet this objective and however that is, they have to meet the legal obligations of the standard. The standard's higher than the objective. That meets our requirements. They'd have to move beyond the spending requirement to actually the savings of 1.5%. And in the conversation that I had with Representative Keeling explains why we think that's very important. And that takes a lot of those kinds of issues off the table. Carbon, there's no legal authority on. Mercury, no legal authority. Big Stone Lake, very little. Exceed that obligation. Those are the kinds of points we got in this kind of agreement, which we think add to the standards applied in energy efficiency and in renewables.
We have a list of 7 people that are wanting to speak, so I'm asking that you keep your comments as concise as possible. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It occurs to me that the people of South Dakota are way more intelligent than we maybe think they are because they get a new power plant, a $1.4 or $5 billion power plant going up on the Minnesota border. They're going to get all the construction dollars. They're going to get all the jobs. They are going to be selling the power to us, and we are also going to be the recipients of their pollution. And it seems to me that if we're going to do that, it would have behooved us to build Excelsior Energy prior to this, because at least we'd have the construction jobs, we'd have the power, and we'd have the tax base here in Minnesota instead of farming it out somewhere else. And I realize that there have been some contesting to the Excelsior Energy going on in front of the PUC, but unlike Big Stone, Excelsior Energy had legislative approval. It had sign-off from the governor The Commerce Department actually negotiated a lot of the language that was in the bill that was in the legislature, and it seems to me that prior to agreeing to Big Stone, Excelsior Energy should have been settled. I understand that ALJ had some adverse findings in regards to that. The PUC did not agree with the ALJ entirely, and in fact has now sent the parties back to negotiating to try and work out an agreement, and in fact has said that we should spread the power out amongst all the utilities and not just Xcel. So is the Commerce Department all going to play a... Are you attempting to be a broker in these deals and make sure that this gets done? Because it seems to me that if we're going to have a power plant in South Dakota, that's going to be polluting Minnesota, when we could have one in Minnesota that is cleaner and more efficient, and has the ability to actually sequester carbon, that we should also be pursuing that course.
Deputy Commissioner?
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Tomasoni, the administrative law judge in the Big Stone case, which you have, I did provide the task force copies of the ALJ findings, did recognize that was a failing of the Big Stone partners. In addition, the Public Utilities Commission recent order in the Excelsior docket so indicated that it should be considered. It is an issue that we're trying to figure out how best to do that. My expectation is that I will be contacting both Xcel and Excelsior to use the word the Public Utilities Commission order set to resume negotiation in coming days. I'll just sort of say candidly to you, Senator Thomas, we haven't done that now because the time for reconsideration hasn't run, and so that kind of question, I could have perhaps should have done it this week, but we have intentions, and I had a conversation with Xcel on that very topic on how we can get that discussion going.
Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have not had any opportunity to read the ALJ's report, but it's my understanding of several things. One, that our new laws were not reflected in the ALJ report. The efficiency law, renewable law, nor were our CO2 goals reflected in the ALJ report. With all the costs of carbon. So it seems somewhat disingenuous to me for you all to rely on such a shallow report to come to something talking about a need for a base load, when that's not what the original forecasts were all about. They were just talking about megawatts and not base loads. But what I really want to go to is your termination of offset requirements in 4.10. I read this and I reread it, and it says that the Minnesota federal program has not been adopted and implemented in 4 years. Implemented in 4 years, then Big Stone is off the hook. And nowhere do I see them being pulled back into the hook. It's like in 4 years, carbon's no longer a problem for them. So the language here is extraordinarily troubling to me, and it seems to me that then the rest of our economy is going to have to deal with the offset or with the carbon that we have because the offsets are no longer in effect. Very troubling.
Deputy Commissioner?
First off, I think it may be useful to the task force for me to read from the top of page 11. I hope you have a copy of page 11. The paragraph 4.3. At the option of the Minnesota owners, the carbon dioxide offsets required in section 4.1 may be achieved by any one or a combination of the following methods, with the goal being to achieve permanent or at a minimum permanent during the entire specified time period the purchase credits are intended to apply, quantifiable, verifiable, and enforceable reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that would not have otherwise occurred. We expect these offsets to be true offsets. Second question. As to the determination, the determination paragraph on page 13, paragraph 4.10, does say that this agreement terminates under two circumstances. One is if a state or federal program intended to reduce the increase of greenhouse gas emissions has been implemented, and I'm reading here, which program applies to the greenhouse gas emissions from the Big Stone unit. So if there is a plan that the state plan or a federal plan that applies to the emissions from this facility, this agreement ceases and they fall in under that plan. The date on this, just to make sure we're clear, is 2012 or beyond. The 4-year clock starts ticking on 2012 or beyond. Because as we were analyzing this, if we don't have a plan in place that's applicable to these emissions by 2016, which would be 4 years from the commercial operation date in 2012, two things will have occurred. One is that we think that this issue is not important and a plan hasn't been implemented, which I don't think is going to be the case, and I don't think should be the case, and I don't think will be the case. But we will have a plan. We will present to you a plan that covers this facility in January 1, and we'll be working on this in the next legislative session for the year to honor. Second, if there isn't a plan in place by 2016 that applies to this, then what we will have done is impose additional costs on Minnesota ratepayers that's unique to these ratepayers and not to any other facility, and we did not think that that was appropriate. That if there isn't a plan in place by 2016, then these should not be the only ratepayers in the state paying for carbon offsets. And but the expectation and consistent throughout is that we will have a plan in place well before the facility is up and running in 2012. It will apply to that, and these offset requirements are that kind of transition.
Senator Charles,
can I follow up, please?
Briefly.
You and I know that Big Stone's going to be here the next legislative session procrastinating. The way this is written, it says adopted and implemented. I mean, a decent lawyer is going to take this and say, I'm off the hook in
2012.
4 years. It's very troubling. Either what you're telling me is something you've read into the document, but not what I'm reading on the page. So that's... And we all know the lobbying pressure that we were under by Big Stone to do nothing. It's going to come back. You give them an incentive to do more, to do nothing.
I do want us to take a breath here a moment, and I know that there are lots of feelings and emotions about this issue, and we do want to express concern, but I think it's important that we not be attributing motives and that we stick with the facts or with the concerns that we do have. So, Deputy Commissioner?
Those were my concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, Representative Levine, I share that concern. But we're reading this very, very differently. In the sense that, but I think my reading and my understanding and my belief that the plan that we adopt as a state, next legislative session or the following legislation will apply and seek to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and put us on the course for 80% reduction by 2050. To do that, these emissions will have to be covered by that. And what this is a transition between what this agreement does and what that plan applies. It is not basically a get out of a plan, some future plan free card. It is not. And in fact, we basically specifically added in the section is that the party's understanding is that Minnesota owners will not be obligated to offset greenhouse gas emissions under both a Minnesota and federal greenhouse gas program at the same time that the Minnesota owners are required to make offsets under the terms of this agreement. One or the other, because they shouldn't be paying twice, but they have to pay one or the other. That is, the Minnesota owners, and I'm reading again from the bottom of page, paragraph 4.10, that is, the Minnesota owners will be required to offset greenhouse gas emissions only according to the terms of this agreement, or one, or either one, a federal greenhouse gas program, or two, a Minnesota greenhouse gas program, and provided the program applies to the greenhouse gas emissions from Big Stone Unit 2. So, we believe very strongly, and we negotiated that point, that this is not, that this is a transition until the new plan that comes into place, that this legislature adopts, that Governor Valenti signs into law, covers it.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I'm still trying to understand all the facts as well. I was gathering, and maybe you could confirm, Mr. Garvey, there was an ALJ decision sometime in August that precipitated or forced the hand, so to speak, of the department to come to a compromise or an agreement on this issue. Is that accurate?
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Chaudhry. The administrative law judge's decision did not force our hand. The department in January, in our initial filing brief, indicated we do not think that as filed, this meets our standards. But here is what we think would meet our criteria. And that's the letter in January 30th, 2007. What I said was, I'm darn glad I was negotiating and be able to do this, because the administrative law judge didn't have the benefit of our settlement discussion or any of these positions, and came out and rejected the department's recommendations or arguments that they hadn't met the standards. And what the administrative law judge concluded is that the commission should consider some of the department's conditions that we had identified in our initial brief.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Gagne, there was an ALJ decision that impacted the final agreement that you came up with.
Senator Chaudhry, the administrative law judge's opinion, in my opinion, says two things. The analysis affirms our underlying analytical belief that there was a need for energy that couldn't be met outright and completely by renewable energy and energy efficiency. Ergo, there was a need for more energy that could be supplied by the facility. Second is, they also said that the applicant had met that burden, contrary to our litigated position. And so what it sort of says to me is, first is our underlying analysis on the need for energy was correct, and secondly, that if we hadn't have had this agreement right now, we would not be talking about carbon, we would not have an agreement with this facility on carbon, we would not be having an agreement on mercury, we would not have an agreement on Big Stone Lake, and we would not be talking about CBEC. That would be right straightforward.
Madam Chair, Mr. Garvey, the ALJ decision came after this agreement.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Chaudhry, no. The administrative law judge was filed on August 15th. We filed this agreement with the Public Utilities Commission on August 31st, several days in advance of the exceptions that parties have
to file with the commission on the ALJ report.
Okay. All right, so I guess at some point I need clarification, so I'm confused about the impact of the ALJ. But the next question I have is, does your agreement, what parts of the agreement fall short of Minnesota, current Minnesota environmental requirements, meet environmental requirements, and which part of the agreement exceeds environmental requirements?
Senator Chaudhry, the renewables section, section seven, we go slightly beyond renewables in the sense that we expect an application of CEQA, slightly beyond.
That's the 180.
180 megawatts. Paragraphs, section 8.0, energy efficiency, it goes just slightly beyond the current demand efficiency law, where we basically expect for aggregation from the munis and co-ops up at the G&T level, the removal of water heater incentives, and the block rate. Minor tweaks above and beyond the law. Mercury, the Minnesota law applicable to mercury is not applicable to, would not be applicable to this facility. It was only applicable to Sherco and Boswell. But yet, 5.0 control of mercury emissions applies that to this facility. The protection of Big Stone Lake, paragraph six, is also above and beyond and different than current law. Carbon.
I'm going to stop you for a minute because we're going through repetition at this point, and we do need to go on. There are other questions, and you have already answered those questions before.
Madam Chair, I don't understand. This is the first time I'm hearing this.
Oh, well, it's not the first time I'm hearing it. and you may pursue those questions again, Senator Chaudhry, but we do have to move on. We do have a deadline that we have to meet. Representative Peterson.
Okay, you guys worked that out. Madam Chair and Mr. Garvey, do you read the Minn Kota Messenger? You know, from the Northwest Co-ops. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I don't need it every time I get it either. But I read it this summer, and this, you know, we have all these, this, you know, we need power, grow, all these megawatts in the queue for wind, Big Stone versus Excelsior, you know, more. But this summer, I read that MISO stated that the max top end big load in 06 summer is the same as the 07 summer. I could hardly believe it. I read it many, many times. It's the same. So where's the growth? And what's that mean for renewables? What's that mean for Big Stone versus Excelsior? So, you know, we've gone round and round on this, and I'm sure we will a lot between now and February. And, you know, I've talked to Governor Rounds' son about South Dakota versus Minnesota, and we've got a, you know, friendly border war going. But I do remember, and Mr. Chair Bretner Solon said earlier about take a breath, is that going up on the South Dakota border, we would go across to buy fireworks. And we would hold our breath with the last breath of Minnesota air before we had to breathe any South Dakota air. It was just this little thing you did as a kid because your dad needed you to shut up. So I'm just gonna hold my breath a little bit as to what's actually gonna happen. You know, because, you know, yes, there's lobbyists, and yes, there's this, and we all know this in this room. I mean, we don't need to pretend. A lot of work will be going on. But my question is, while holding breath, because Minnesota air is better than South Dakota's, that's a joke. And that realizing that Sherco plant is pretty high in CO2 in the nation, I believe. Why is it such that Xcel seems to have a no new carbon plan, but the Big Stone partners don't? What's the difference there? The biggest utility in the state is saying, we don't want any more carbon emissions. But the others seem to have to explain and explain and explain and explain and explain and offset and this and that and cap and trade this and that and that and that to explain the 4.7 tons per year of carbon coming out of Big Stone 2. So why is one utility that has half the power in the state so completely different than the other partners? Just gonna hold your breath, that's fine.
Representative, are you wanting a response to this?
I was just making an observation and the difference. Yeah, we can cut time. That's fine.
Madam Chairman.
Deputy Commissioner.
Members of the task force, Representative Peterson. I've thought about that question a little bit. I don't know the definitive answer, but I believe the answer goes to the XL system has a large percentage of nuclear power on their system. They, as part of the MERP settlement, upgraded and added capacity onto their system. They have contract potential, in fact, and in the future with Manitoba Hydro. So they have an additional set of resources and a more varied resource. They also have a very different renewable energy standard obligation on them, 30% by 2020 as opposed to 25 by 25. So these kinds of things play themselves out in this kind of setting.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really just wanted to respond to what Mr. Garvey said back when we were having a little discussion earlier. So you had suggested that your brief and your argument was really about just replacing part of Big Stone, but I just want to be clear that I don't believe that's what it says. I think it says very clearly that you said in your brief, Big Stone applicants have failed to satisfy most of the legal requirements for certificate of need under Minnesota law, including forecast, renewable preference, and conservation. And it says not that it part of it can't be replaced, but that it seems to not be replaced more cost effectively. That's the showing that they didn't make. And so I think the brief was extremely clear that they didn't meet the requirements of Minnesota law, and that they didn't have a they could not show the law, and that they didn't have a they could not show that the plant was needed. That's what your brief said, and that's what your experts in your department said. And it concerns me greatly that I don't hear that opinion being expressed today. And I don't know why. And I'm not trying to be political, and I'm not trying to be personal about this. I'm just telling you that's the fact way that I see them. And that concerns me greatly. And I do think also that, that this whole offset deal is it just looks phony to me because, it's all based on us passing a strong law. If we don't pass a strong law, then they can emit CO2 for 50 more years without penalty. And, so perhaps part of the agreement should have been that they have to agree not to come and lobby us not to pass a law. Obviously, it doesn't say that, and we know what's going to happen. No holds will be barred to try to prevent us from passing that law. So, really, it's kind of passing the buck to the legislature to say, you got to stop them from doing this. You got to make them do something because this doesn't make them do anything permanently. For 4 years, you have to transfer some money into a fund, and you could say that it's intended to be create permanent offsets. But after 4 years, there's nothing permanent. CO2, the plant's going to be around for at least 50 years. There's nothing that's going to happen after that unless we do something. And so I don't see this settlement as protecting the public interest in Minnesota or our future.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, members of the task force, Senator Anderson, I'm supremely confident that we will pass the carbon mitigation law. I'm supremely confident and expect that the federal government will also pass the carbon mitigation law. we have a recent agreement where the only plant in the country would actually have to do offsets under this arrangement. I understand that it might, that people might say it's not enough, but we weren't in the position to sort of say no new energy facility until we get a plan. We need to develop the transition. Our legal brief was very hard-hitting. We believed that. At that time, they did not do adequately on renewables. They did not do adequately on energy efficiency. But in the intervening 3 months, nation-leading energy efficiency and renewables laws passed, and they addressed the other thing. Otherwise, the section at the end of the brief would not have been there, nor would our policy letter at the beginning.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief as well. I just want a quick statement and a question. That in section 4.3, the offset methods on page 11, the third line is the loophole so big you can drive an old school coal generating facility through it, put it on wheels and rock and roll. You can make goals. You know, my goal is to make my wife incredibly happy for, we joke, the next 62 years. I'm commitment phobia.
There's no doubt in my mind that you will.
Well, it might be my goal or my expectation. It's a ton of work. It's my 1 month anniversary. Indulge me for a second. It's a ton of work. I can't just make it my goal. It must be. I mean, replace those six words with which must be permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, and enforceable reduction. Then we can talk. We're talking about an open-ended offset here. And I think that goes to the heart of, of what this discussion is. My question for you is, in advocating for granting a certificate of need for this transmission line for Big Stone 2, is it your understanding that we start at zero, and what would the world be, what would the electrical demand be without, let's say 2012, without RES at 12%, I believe, 2012, without the 4 years of 1.5% reduction savings. And then you comply with the two laws, and then you say, we've done this, so then we've met 216B.243, and we deserve a certificate of need. Or is it your impression that one must start from a base of it satisfying with those laws, and then saying, can we do more conservation and efficiency? Can we do more renewables first, as 216B.243 requires by statute? And then only if you can't cost effectively do that, then you can do coal generation.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chairman, member of the task force, Representative Kalin. You just threw me a curveball in the mid question, because I thought you were talking about a baseline for carbon. But I think you're more on a certificate of need analysis, on what does it take to get a certificate of need, which may actually be the answer to Senator Chaudhry's question. The answer that we've always applied is sort of threefold, that you need to be meeting the law, and then we do the analysis on if meeting the law isn't enough, but there's more that a utility could do to achieve that would reduce or eliminate the need for the facility, they should do that, as long as it's a cost effective and reasonable thing to do. And we did not think that they met that burden.
in our litigation position, in our brief. I mean, let me be crystal clear. We did not think that they were doing adequately on energy efficiency and renewables. Two things happened. Passage of the RES, turning the standard, the law into a stretch standard, 25 by 25, turning the demand efficiency into a much more of a obligation than just a spend the money wisely approach. Do we think that hitting those numbers as we expect them to, as the law requires them to do, is about as much as we can expect our utilities to? And then we did the analysis that if they hit those numbers, if all the energy efficiency of that 1.5 is devoted to load management as opposed to peaking, which I think is a big dip, if all that energy is what's the capacity of the renewables? And how do you do that? If you start analyzing that out and you still need the energy from a baseload facility, we would say you've met the criteria for that. Our next step was, are you meeting our expectations of overall environmental obligations? And here's where we said, no, you need to do carbon, you need to do mercury, you need to do Big Stone Lake, and we want you to do CFETs. And so that's the way we made the move from our litigation position as espoused in January, at the beginning of this legislative session, last year, before the legislature convened, to the settlement.
Madam Chair, just really briefly, I think that
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of being too obvious and explicit, I think that the settlement smacks too much of follow the law, and you're satisfying 216B.243 of the certificate of need. I frankly think that's a very difficult reading of the law, of the certificate of need statute, and I don't think that's what Minnesotans want the Department of Commerce to be advocating for. It's just, you know, follow off, do the best you can, have a goal, and we'll be good to go. I just think that we can do a lot better than what we have, and that it's certainly not bold or better stewardship of the planet.
Okay, thank you. We are going to have to move on at this point. And we are going to skip the deed report today. Sorry about that. And we're going to move on to the CBED Advisory Task Force and the RFP hiring process. And very quickly, and I hope to adjourn in 5 minutes. So, who's first? John Fuller or Bob Ela? Okay.
I'll go first, Madam Chair. Thank you. I abide by the 5 minute rule here. As task force members know, the legislature gave the task force a number of things to accomplish during this interim session. One of the things it did was create a community-based energy development advisory task force to study a number of issues regarding seabed definitions and a lot of other things. That task force was created, filled with members, and had its initial meeting on July 18th. At that point, I think given the charge that the legislature gave to that task force, staff determined and spoke with members of the task force about this too, that certain expertise was needed to help them achieve their goals, specifically the hiring of consultants to provide three different kinds of services. One, a facilitator for the group as a whole. There are 24 members, it's a very large group. Second, given the large number of economic tasks given to this group in terms of defining what benefits go to communities from different models of seabed development, we felt an economic analyst was needed to give advice along those lines. And finally, we folded in another study that the legislator had required of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force with respect to potential changes in the easement law regarding wind easements. And since the people on this task force will also be interested in those issues, we just made that another job for the task force to do, and consequently we think a legal expert to offer advice on those issues is necessary as well. The Electric Energy Task Force was also given the charge of conducting a study of the comparative cost of a new nuclear plant built in Minnesota with some advanced coal facilities, and we believe a consulting expertise is needed to help discharge that charge as well. I believe in your packets is a resolution that has two parts. One, it authorizes the Executive Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission to publish in the State Register requests for proposals for those first three experts that I mentioned, and also for requests for proposals for help with the nuclear study. The second part of the resolution authorizes the co-chairs of this body to actually enter into contracts on behalf of the task force as a whole for the services described in those requests for proposals. Madam Chair, we think that's one way of expediting all these studies so that we can get done on time for next session, rather than requiring another convening of the entire task force and having them vote on that.
I'm not okay. This is the RFP.
This is a two-part resolution.
Okay, this is the resolution that's being referred to then,
right,
in issuing the RFPs, and then let me give you a chance to just look that over, and I think that it would be appropriate if we were to have a motion supporting this.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Fossen.
I move approval of the resolution.
Thank you. Any discussion on that? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Anything further? Mr. Fuller? Okay. We are looking at the next meeting of the LEPF to be on October 31st. It would be a 10 o'clock. It's a Friday morning. It would be on a Friday morning at about 10 o'clock in the morning. Pardon, Representative Bruce?
Wednesday
is rather difficult for some people from Greater Minnesota who have work schedules also, but we have been meeting on Wednesdays, and we thought we would try a Friday this time. Unfortunately, it is a Wednesday. Another vacation day.
So it
will be on a Wednesday.
Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
Would you, as chairs, consider maybe Friday the 2nd or the Friday before? Typically, that might be easier for several
on Friday
members. Whether you're locked into the date or the day, we can change the date rather than the day just as easy.
Madam Chair, there.
My suggestion. For me, I know offhand right now that would make a difference in making it or not.
That the 31st doesn't work for you?
No.
Senator Kugler?
Well, I think there are, some other things around there, too, I guess. I've already blocked out the 31st, and I don't know. I just don't keep it where it is, I guess, but that's my own opinion.
That the 31st does work for you?
Yeah.
I tell you what we'll do. We will pull the members and try to come up with a meeting time that accommodates the greatest number, okay? But it will be around that time of the month. So, thank you. The meeting is adjourned.